Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, sometimes it's the behavior that gets your attention. Sometimes it's the language. So it was a couple of weeks ago, I was flying from Los Angeles to New Orleans, Louisiana. And given all the flying I've done over the past 6 months, much of it in commercial aircraft, it's astonishing to me, sitting here talking to you, that this was the first time I was afforded the opportunity to go through one of the newfangled scanners that you've heard so much about. And true to my own proclaimed philosophy here on this broadcast, pat-downs are for now, radiation is forever, I said to the TSA agent, thanks very much. I don't want the radiation. I'll take the pat-down. And so, with the cheery call, opt-out, ringing in my ears, I was escorted to the pat-down area, the pat-down lounge. And the male TSA official, I wish he was PSA, the male TSA official gave me a rundown of what was in my immediate future. Now, this was not the new, really severely enhanced pat-down, because the first thing the officer said to me, or among the first things he said, is, I'm going to be using the back of my hand. And, of course, you've heard, as I have, that in some of these pat-downs now they use the front of the hand. Ugh. Oh, please. But no, he used the back of his hand. But here's what got my attention and what dared me to keep a straight face in the midst of this process. He said, I'm going to use the back of my hand. Now he's done my torso, my upper body, ladies and gentlemen, just to give you a word picture, a word's eye view. And now he's going down, I say, to the lower half of my body. And what he says is, because he's narrating this before he does it, and it's clearly a script because he says it before each leg. You see, he says, I'm going to use the back of my hand to go up your leg until I encounter resistance. And that's the moment where I thought, you know, if I was the smartass everybody thinks I am, I'd say something right now, but I'd like to get on my plane. So, but two legs, twice he says, okay, I'm going to use the back of my hand and go up your leg until I encounter resistance. And the good news is, going up both legs, he encountered resistance. Thank you. Hello, welcome to the show. Say, me, 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 this the ling, the goo, mine, a convalina, ratcha, chacha,
umalacha, olive, I loo. That means we're glad to be here. We're really glad to be here. Ladies and gentlemen, children too, here's five boys to do the show for you. We're gonna turn all around, we're gonna touch the ground. We're gonna shim, sham, shimmy all around. We're gonna shim, sham, shimmy all over the state. We're gonna shim, sham, shimmy till we get paid. Because we're glad to be here.
I know we're glad to be here. Think it's safe to do a tango. Yeah, we're doing some an angle. The back, the back, from the side to side. The back, from the side to side. Say, he only mean he just don't need your mind. Kamalina, Raja, Tatcha, Umalacha, Alabalu. That means we're glad to be here. You know we're glad to be here.
We're really glad to be here.
We're really glad to be here.
We're gonna turn all around. We're gonna touch the ground. We're gonna shim, jam, shimmy all around. We're gonna shim, jam, over the stage. We're gonna shim, jam, shimmy till we get paid. We're gonna wear our pants above our knees. We're gonna shake this stage just to please, because we're glad to be here.
I know we're glad to be here.
Thank you.
the front, to the back, from the side to side, to the back, to the front, from the side to side. Say, eeny, meeny, just a leaner, you a minor, combalina, racha, chacha, puma, lacha, alabaloo. That means it's nice to have been here.
Really nice to have been here.
See you once again here, we hope.
From London, England, home of the royal wedding and the 2012 Olympics, I'm Harry Shearer. Welcome you to this edition of the show. And apropos of the story I told you at the top of the broadcast about my first enhanced pat-down, totally coincidentally, really nutty coincidence time, this Monday, tomorrow in most of these areas, on MyDamnChannel.com premieres the video of my little tune about the whole nutty affair, Touch My Junk. And speaking of the royal wedding, here's news from outside the bubble. With Britain mired in economic gloom, this is from the Guardian newspaper in London, the announcement of the engagement of Prince William and Kate Middleton promised a glimmer of hope. Foreign visitors would pour in, ran the government's theory, and David Cameron endorsed a £50 million plan, to use the event to sell Britain, quote, as the perfect tourist destination. But far from the event being a guaranteed money spinner, a senior tourism official has privately warned the evidence points to foreign visitors steering clear of the UK around the time of the April 29th wedding. Internal correspondence obtained from Visit Britain, the government's tourism agency, has revealed that visitor numbers are expected to fall, despite official claims it would deliver an enormous boost for the British tourism industry. Sandy Daw, Visit Britain's chief executive, promised the royal wedding would deliver, quote, a welcome boost, not just to the tourism industry in London, but across Britain. It would create a halo effect that would carry over into the Olympic year 2012. Unquote. Britain's monarch generates over £500 million a year directly and indirectly from overseas tourists. The benefit of a royal wedding is likely to outstrip that, she said. But 2 days after the engagement was announced, Visit Britain's head of research and forecasting, David Edwards, emailed colleagues with what he described as, quote, more actual evidence, like from the reality-based world. Quote, if we look at the marriage of Andrew and Sarah in July 1986, we find that across the year as a whole, there were 4% fewer visitors to Britain than in 1985. In July 1986, there were 8% fewer than in July of 1985, he said. While this and results relating to 1981 are inconclusive, such as it is, the evidence points to royal weddings having a negative impact on inbound tourism. Foreign visits in July 1981, when Charles and Diana married, were down 15% on average for the same period from 1980 to 1985, according to the Office of National Statistics. Asked about the apparent discrepancy between the public statements and the internal advice, Visit Britain said it believes the biggest effect would come in the longer term, with more visitors planning trips after seeing the wedding on TV. Daw said she believed, contrary to the evidence in previous royal nuptials, that London would benefit considerably from visitors for the wedding, and there might be some positive effect in other parts of the country. She said the bulk of new visitors attracted to the UK would not come for months or even years after the wedding. Possibly centuries. No, that's me. It acts as a showcase for Britain that will turn into visitors in subsequent years, she said. Yes, can actually turn into humans. Many Britons are already considering leaving the country to make the most of an 11-day break, achieved by taking 3 days leave, linking the Easter wedding and May Day public holidays. Thompson Holidays and Thomas Cook have reported a 35% rise in bookings over the same time last year. The budget airline Ryanair reported a 65% surge in bookings of flights out of Britain. Tourists might take the view this is not a great time to visit the UK because everything is geared to the wedding, says Neil Saunders. A verdict beats me. If they want to go to London as part of a wider trip, they will find prices are elevated. Hey, y'all come. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has issued a travel alert about the high level of terrorist threat in the U.K. that is due to stay in place until after the wedding. So high prices, high terrorism alert. Y'all come squared. Last June's royal wedding in Sweden. Remember that? You remember that? Sweden. Royal wedding between Crown Princess Victoria and Daniel Westling. That was, I guess, pro-Westling. Failed to spark expected tourist interest. 3 days before the wedding, the director of the city's five-star Hilton Hotel told local radio that bookings were down compared to a normal June weekend, with the wedding reportedly drawing fewer visitors than the Stockholm Marathon. See last week's Le Show for more information on marathons. The Swedish rail company also had to cancel 2 of 3 special wedding trains to Stockholm due to a lack of interest. And on the subject of the new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, from Reuters, Deadline Baghdad, Iraq's capital wants the United States to apologize, you see, and pay $1 billion for the damage done to the city, not by bombs, that's okay, we like the bombs, but by blast walls and Humvees since the U.S.-led invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein. The city's government issued its demands in a statement this week that said Baghdad's infrastructure and aesthetics have been seriously damaged by the American military. Hey, babe, shake hands with New Orleans. The U.S. forces changed this beautiful city to a camp in an ugly and destructive way, which reflected deliberate ignorance and carelessness about the simplest forms of public taste, the statement said. Using the words U.S. and public taste in the same sentence just tells you how little they know about us. Quote, due to the huge damage leading to a loss the Baghdad municipality cannot afford, we demand the American side apologize to Baghdad's people and pay back these expenses, unquote. The statement made no mention of damage caused by bombing. That's just like urban renewal, I guess. Baghdad's neighborhoods have been sealed off by miles of concrete blast walls. Those are lovely. You wouldn't want those in your neighbor. You would. It's like a gated neighborhood. Except transforming the city into a tangled maze, says Reuters, that contributes to massive traffic jams. Gated city? Traffic jams? We made you into L.A. Despite a sharp reduction in overall violence in recent years, except for last year, only 5% of the walls have been removed. The heavy blast walls have damaged sewer and water systems, pavement, and parks, says the city spokesman. U.S. military Humvees driven on street median strips and through gardens have also caused major damage, he says. The city of Baghdad feels these violations, which have taken place for years, have caused economic and moral damage, unquote. Weren't those Humvees that were driving through New Orleans and for like months after the... Baghdad isn't badly in need of a facelift, says Reuters reporter. Electricity and trash collection are sporadic. You're welcome. Streets are potholed, and sewage treatment plants and pipes have not been renovated for years. Iraq has seen growing protests in recent weeks over poor government services, inspired by, I guess, the liberation of Iraq, those protests have been. The spokesman said the city's statement would be the start of its measures to get the United States to pay for damages. He did not say what other steps might be taken. You know how to teach us a lesson, Baghdad? Hold the Olympics there. Seriously. That would freak us out. News from outside the bubble, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to read the trades for you. This is from Marketing Daily. You get that, don't you? You get a daily. Coke continues rebound, but diet news stings. I'll read it for you. Just as Coca-Cola released 2010 results showing strong global growth and actual growth in North American carbonated soda drinks, for the third quarter in a row, bucking a long downward trend. The simultaneous news on the diet soda front delivered a blow to all mainstream soda makers. That news? Daily diet soda drinkers appear to be at significantly higher risk for strokes and other vascular events, according to just released results of government-funded research. Not just migraines that mimic strokes, actual strokes. The timing of the diet soda research news threatens to perhaps take some of the edge off of Pepsi's planned unveiling of a sleek new Diet Pepsi skinny can during a Diet Pepsi party being thrown as part of New York's Fashion Week. Sure, fashion and diet cola go together, don't they? The stroke research, a large long-term study conducted by Columbia University and Miami's Miller School of Medicine, was launched way back in 1993 to track stroke incidences and risk factors in a multi-ethnic urban population. The kind you live in a gated community to avoid? The results released during the American Stroke Association annual conference, people who drink diet soda every day have a 61% higher risk of stroke or vascular events than those who report no diet soda drinking. The study results were also far from good news for makers of packaged goods or beverages containing high sodium levels. Research found that stroke risk increased 16% for every 500 milligrams of sodium consumed every day. Only a third of study participants met the U.S. Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which recommend a maximum daily sodium intake of 2,300 milligrams. In addition, only 12% met the 1,500 milligram daily maximum recommended by the American Heart Association, and now recommended by the Dietary Guidelines of the U.S. government for those with certain risk factors. The average daily sodium intake of participants in the study was 3,031 milligrams, about a third more than the maximum recommended. On the diet soda front, the researchers said they accounted for participants' age, sex, race, or ethnicity, smoking status, exercise, alcohol consumption, and daily caloric intake, and even after also accounting for subjects' metabolic syndromes, peripheral vascular disease, and heart disease history, the increased stroke risk for daily diet soda drinkers was 48%. The researchers did not identify what factors associated with diet soda might be responsible for the higher risks. The American Beverage Association quickly released a statement from its Senior Vice President for Science Policy, Maureen Story, who is a physician, asserting there's no evidence that diet soda uniquely causes increased risk of strokes or vascular events. She also stressed the research did not factor in subject family stroke histories and that the body of scientific evidence shows that diet soda can be, quote, a useful weight management tool, unquote. None of which can be music to the ears of those that either Pepsi or Coke. Coke Zero, also positioned in large degree to attract men who want full-flavored taste in a diet soda, has become one of the company's most recent successful product launches ever. What remains to be seen is how the beverage industry as a whole, and the major brands in particular, will respond, or perhaps not respond, to the bad press for diet soda. Clearly, this diet soda news is getting a lot of attention and is of great concern for beverage marketers, says Laura Rees, partner in the Rees & Rees branding consultancy. And she continues, the consumer confusion factor will be exacerbated because the research doesn't identify the specific cause of the diet soda risk factor. Is it the sweetener or the carbonation or some other factor that might even be biological to individuals? She asks. The carbonation. Good guess, babe. You should be a doctor. But at the same time, Rees points out there's been long-running debate and controversy about the health implications of artificial sweeteners and whether such sweeteners in general and in diet sodas in particular might actually trigger metabolic or psychological cravings for sweet tastes, ultimately perhaps contributing to weight gain rather than helping consumers reduce overall caloric intake, she says. Lacking such answers as to the culprit, she continues, it would be very difficult for beverage makers to effectively counter these study findings through messaging campaigns. And perhaps even more important, we know that in most cases, the more a company responds to or protests in these kinds of situations, the guiltier they seem to appear in consumers' perceptions. So bottom line, she says, I would say that getting actively publicly engaged in this controversy would be the worst thing beverage makers could do. Just hush up, Coke and Pepsi. The advice we glean when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Street, down Chapel Street, they'll jump you, cut your throat as soon as give you the eye. Those wholesome girls down Chapel Street, they need some place to move their feet before they soothe you with a lullaby. Tower of Babel, Chapel Street, there's coffee bars where the villains meet the stars. Money's changing hands under the table. But we're gonna dance till they shut the door, till they clear the floor, till they beg for more. Well, she's the kind of squeeze that you can't read.
Thank you so much. I love you all. This is Le Show from London. Ladies and gentlemen, make your tourism plans for next year now. I know times are tough, so maybe this year's vacation ain't happening anyway. So this is good news, really. Part of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Interpretive Museum in downtown Vicksburg, Mississippi, is opening in March 2012. That's right. The Corps of Engineers has its own museum. Think of it. Corps Senior Project Manager Mike Reniger says the $16 million, just roll those around in your head, those words, $16 million Lower Mississippi River Museum and Riverfront Interpretive Center will be built in three stages because of limited workspace in the downtown Vicksburg area. Vicksburg, why don't you get bigger? Make room for the museum, babe. The Vicksburg Post reports that Reniger told a Vicksburg, I'm sorry for going falsetto on you. I just get passionate about the Corps of Engineers Museum. The Vicksburg Post reports that Reniger told a Vicksburg Main Street meeting that completion of all three stages is expected by August of next year. The stages, the three stages, don't get excited, doesn't mean rock and roll performers will appear. The stages include the museum aboard the MV Mississippi 4, that's the centerpiece, the Fairground Strait Bridge relocation, come on, let's go, and the installation of the Mississippi River flood model. She's pretty. Reniger said the museum will be finished first and will feature an aquarium. Featuring all the fish the Corps killed. No! What do you mean? Interactive exhibits, self-guided tours. A sediment table that will display a tracking of water movement and an orientation theater showing movies about the Corps. Hey! And life on the river. If you want to see my movie about the Corps, don't go there. Dublin this week. Dublin, Ireland. Tuesday. No aquarium. Once construction of the museum building is complete, contractors will begin disassembling the 142-year-old Fairground Street Bridge that has been closed to traffic and reassemble the refurbished version of the bridge to serve as a walkway between, I think they mean among, the downtown attractions. Vicksburg has more than two, don't they? The major feature is the bridge, Reniger said. It was built in 1868 in Dubuque, Iowa. It was erected in Vicksburg in 1895 and meant to take a horse and buggy from the city over railroad tracks to the river. The final stage of the work is the installation. Of course, having been done back then, the bridge probably still works. The final stage of work is the installation of the Mississippi River flood model, an 800-acre river basin that will be trimmed down to simulate the river between Greenville and Vicksburg. Why would they bother to take it all the way to New Orleans? That would be embarrassing. Groundbreaking for the center began in 2009, but the conception of building a museum began in 1992. So that's core time. It's like core years is like dog years in reverse. The project hit a snag last March when an underground land shift occurred on the work site. Who could have predicted that? The Corps of Engineers Museum, ladies and gentlemen. Come on. Let's make a half a day of it.
He's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an inspector general.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory has failed to keep accurate records of dangerous drugs in its inventory, including cocaine, amphetamines, opium, and black tar heroin. This is a nuclear research lab in the San Francisco Bay Area, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a meth lab. This according to the Inspector General for the Energy Department. The lab did not keep track of at least six of 42 controlled substances that it maintains for biomedical and forensic science research because, quote, officials did not devote adequate attention to developing and maintaining program accountability, unquote, meaning out for coffee. Although the quantities of drugs in question are small, and there was no evidence that any substances had been misused or stolen, the discrepancies, quote, could create an opportunity for improper or illegal use, according to the Inspector General. In response, officials with the National Nuclear Security Administration, which operates the lab, say they have already made changes or plan to amend procedures in tracking the drugs. We agree there is a need for a rigorous system of controls for managing the inventory of controlled substances, says Gerald Talbot, associate administrator. Inspectors determined the lab had no requirements that drugs be weighed when they were transferred from one place to another to ensure quantities didn't disappear. The lab failed to show the amount of cocaine it had on hand. One notation read simply, one bottle. The lab recorded widely divergent amounts of how much of amphetamine it kept and had five times more opium and 20 times more heroin than what its records indicated. Lab spokesman Jim Bono said the majority of the substances were in quantities of less than a gram. All drug samples, he said, are kept in a safe. Some of the substances have been housed at the lab for a decade. The heroin discrepancy was probably, according to Bono, the result of the sample absorbing moisture from the air. You know, congrats, Jim Bono, for that one. Folks, if you're ever caught with, you know, too much heroin, there you go. It was the air. I thought I had, like, and foreclosures in the United States matched their highest level on record at the end of 2010, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. And Neil Borofsky, the Special Inspector General for the TARP program, says the Obama administration's program to prevent foreclosures is broken. This just in. And that many of the people it's supposed to be helping are now, quote, in a far worse place than they would have been had this program not existed, unquote. When he took his job of keeping tabs in the Treasury Department, Borofsky says he received quite a welcome to Washington, a mildew-ridden office in the basement. After a while, he started to feel ill. He finally complained. It turned out there was an open sewage drain right under that office. We were literally breathing in raw sewage. Welcome to Washington. He now has built a team of more than 100 auditors and white-collar criminal investigators, thwarting attempts to steal hundreds of millions in taxpayer dollars. One part of the TARP program in particular has been a failure, the Obama administration's foreclosure prevention plan, he says. I just fear it is the one aspect of TARP that had the opportunity to have a really, really meaningful impact on millions of families, and it's an opportunity that's lost, he says. The Home Affordable Modification Program, HAMP, was supposed to help between 3 and 4 million Americans stay in their homes, and not the people who acted recklessly or were flipping condos. But, quote, we're not going to come anywhere close to that number, Borofsky says. Over the past 2 years, the program has reached only 500,000 people. Treasury Department says that's a success. 500,000 people get to stay in their homes. Borofsky says even more people are getting rejected from the program for the wrong reasons and are getting foreclosed on when they shouldn't be. Quote, it is absolutely heartbreaking the number of families that are not being reached by this program, he says. P.S. He's leaving the job. He wants to spend more time with his family or, just relax and smell the mildew.
Down in the city, it's a pity what's there. Oh, the kids in the gutter running really bare. How much money do I have to get? Getting me set where the jet set gas. Like up on the hill where they do the boogie. The boogie. I wonder what they're doing when they do the boogie. And I wonder what I'm doing here. Down in the city, if you ain't dead, you better watch that man, he gonna bust your head, or throw you over and leave you alone. He's a 20 minutes late, he gotta be back home, way up on the hill where they do the boogie. Boogie. I wonder what they're doing when they do the boogie, and I wonder what I'm doing here. Rats in the alley and a roach on the floor. A businessman a hunting for a two-bit whore. I thought I heard some housewives say I gotta go up the hill for the PTA. Meets up on the hill where they do the boogie. Boogie. I wonder what they're doing. when they do the boogie, and I wonder what I'm doing here. Some folks say that a hippie won't steal, but I caught three in my cornfield. One had a flag and the other had a bomb, and the third old boy was getting on home way up on the hill where they do the boogie. The boogie. I wonder what they're doing when they do the boogie, and I wonder what I'm doing here. Now all I know about is what I read. I see you coming at me on a TV screen. Every time the boogie, well, it gives me a thrill. But they always seem to do it way up on the hill. Way up on the hill where they do the boogie. The boogie. I wonder what they're doing when they do the boogie. And I wonder what I'm doing here.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news about our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Safe, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, safe, too safe to meet. Safe, safe, too safe to meet.
Yeah, it's all that. The levels of groundwater contamination. What? From a radioactive isotope have plunged at the Plymouth, Massachusetts nuclear power plant in recent weeks. The plant's operators don't seem to be much closer, though, to figuring out the source of the problem. Despite the sharp decline, representatives for the Plymouth and plant and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission say it's far too early to know if the problem has gone away. Last summer, tritium, there's that isotope again, tritium levels in a monitoring well at the nuclear power plant site exceeded 25,000 picocuries per liter. Don't worry, it's no threat to... Adding to concerns about a potential leak at the plant. The tritium levels in the monitoring well only exceeded the federal maximum for drinking water, 20,000 picocuries per liter, on one other occasion in September. Just one other... The tritium levels in that well have fluctuated wildly, however, since that time, and have significantly been above levels that could be caused by typical atmospheric conditions. In recent weeks, there's been this downward trend, according to the NRC. Meanwhile, tritium levels have been stuck in an elevated range in a nearby monitoring well. The plant's operators have been vexed. Vexed, I say, by the tritium levels since they were first spotted last year, although they have not been found close to a drinking water source. Carol Whiteman, spokesman for the owner, the Entergy Corporation, say Entergy is currently focused on tracking chemical dyes placed at four separate spots at the plant to see if they flow into any of the monitoring wells. The spokesperson for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says it's far too early to say that the problem that caused the spike in tritium levels has been solved. Elevated tritium levels have been spotted at many other nuclear power plants in recent years, a problem that many believe is caused by the aging infrastructure at the plants. Fortunately, we're not storing high-level waste at those plants. They'd have to last for 100,000 years. Imagine how the infrastructure would happen. And Deadline Brattleboro, Vermont, during routine surveillance, steam was seen coming from the high-pressure coolant injection system at the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant this week. All unnecessary personnel were cleared from the reactor building as a precautionary measure, and valves in the steam path were closed, said Yankee's manager of communication. The issue has been entered into the corrective action systems, and an investigation has been started to determine the source of the steam. There was no release of radioactive materials to the environment. The leak was repaired. Unlike the leaks of tritium at Vermont Yankee, which have not yet been repaired. It's clean, it's safe, it's cheap, it's too safe to clean it, and it's nuclear power. It's our friend the Atom. And he's gone. Bye, Addy.
Goodbye.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, another fine comic character in the modern pantheon, Curveball, or as his driver's license calls him, Rafid Ahmed Alwan Al-Janabi. He was the source for Colin Powell's speech at the United Nations on the subject of mobile bioweapons vans, Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons capability. Nearly every word he told his interrogators from Germany's Secret Service, the BND, he now says, was a lie. This has been known before, but it's the first time it comes from his lips, so of course it's a lie. Everything he said about the inner workings of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program was a flight of fantasy, he told the British newspaper The Guardian, one that he now claims was aimed at ousting Hussein. Janabi was a chemical engineering graduate who had worked in Iraqi industry. He was shocked, he says, as Powell's presentation revealed that the Bush administration's decision makers had swallowed what he had said. Something else left him even more amazed. Until that point, he had not met a U.S. official, let alone been interviewed by one. Quote, I had the chance to fabricate something to topple the regime, he said. I and my sons are proud of that. Curveball's identity has been sought throughout Europe and Iraq. He has refused, under the orders of the German intelligence agency, the BND, to cooperate with reporters until now. He says he was granted asylum by the German government in 2000, less than 6 months after arriving in Germany. The story about the biochemical weapons, he says, has nothing to do with my asylum claims. About 3 weeks after he was granted asylum, a German official whom he identified as Dr. Paul, I guess Dr. Robert wasn't available, came to see him. He said he needed some information about my life. He said it was very important that Iraq had a dictator and that I needed to help. At this point, according to Curveball, he decided to let his imagination run wild. For the next 6 months, he sat with Paul, the BND's resident expert on WMDs, and manufactured a tale of dread. His claims later were quoted by former Secretary of State Colin Powell, one of the most trusted men in America. A German politician has warned that Curveball could go to jail. In Germany, for warmongering. That's a crime? I thought you'd get medals for that. Politicians in Iraq called for Curveball's permanent exile following his claim that he wants to return to his homeland and build a political party, said one Iraqi MP. He is a liar. He will not serve his country. In his adopted home of Germany, members of parliament are demanding to know why the German Secret Service paid Curveball $5,000 a month for at least 5 years after they knew he had lied. Yes, there is a German law which makes warmongering illegal. Nutty old country. Old Europe. And Colin Powell has called on the CIA and the Pentagon to explain why they failed to alert him to the unreliability of Curveball. Powell said the CIA and the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon's military intelligence arm, should face questions about why they failed to sound the alarm about Curveball. He demanded to know why it had not been made clear to him that Curveball was, according to intelligence experts all the way up to George Tenet, then head of the CIA, totally unreliable before his false information was put into the President's State of the Union address and to his own speech to the UN. Trying to stay most trusted, I guess. But Germany's former foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, says the former head of the CIA, George Tenet, made implausible claims about the handling of the Curveball case. Tenet, this week, issued a statement on his website saying he discovered too damn late that Curveball was a fabricator. Asked by the Guardian newspaper whether Tenet's claims were plausible, the former German foreign minister said, quote, no, I don't think so. Curveball, ladies and gentlemen. At least he's not a Scroogey.
were a bold Iraqi. Saddam you couldn't stand, so you became a migrant in a foreign land. Ended up in Germany, got to know some spies, got yourself a code name, much to your surprise. Hey curveball, throwing loose and wild. Hey curveball, got them all beguiled. Had them believing and begging for more. All I did was try to start an 8-year war. You did engineering back in your Baghdad days, so you were always turning a kind of techie phrase. Tunisia, Egypt, don't forget Libya too. All of them could have used a guy like you. Hey curveball, admiring your pitch. Hey curveball, like throwing a switch. It was all true, so you swore. All I did was help to start an 8-year war. You came up with info you knew would please. Fans for bioweapons, making WMDs. They didn't probe and they didn't press. Your friends and you were on the Invasion Express. Hey curveball, you got some nice dough for telling us what you don't know. You were the winner if you're keeping score. All I did was try to start an 8-year war. You could have stayed and fought for what you believed. It would have been risky, pain you might have received. Your lies killed the tyrant, that's all she wrote. Too bad the dead and injured didn't get a vote. Hey curveball, you were born to lead. Too bad your country doesn't feel the need. You steered clear of the blood and gore. I just made a bundle off an 8-year war.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Let's start with Whoopi Goldberg, shall we? Whoopi Goldberg apologized to the New York Times this week on her TV show that she's part of, The View, for calling an article in the paper which talked about African Americans who won Oscars, but did not mention her. She called it sloppy journalism. The article discussed the lack of black nominees in this year's Oscars, but did not reference Goldberg's 1990 win for Ghost. The Times responded saying that the article was not meant to be comprehensive. It's the Times, after all. Then Goldberg tried to put an end to the feud. Quote, I said I felt the reporting was shoddy, and for that I'm going to apologize, okay? I personally found the article really confusing, and as I said, I was also quite hurt that Cuba Gooding Jr., Louis Gossett Jr., and myself were not included in this expose about black Hollywood. But for saying it was shoddy reporting, I apologize, New York Times. Tiger Woods apologized after he was fined an undisclosed sum by the European Tour this week for spitting on the green. It's a great Irish tradition. No, it's not. Spitting on the green during the final round of the Dubai Desert Classic. Well, the grass needed the tour. It's the desert. What the tour said in a statement that tournament director Mike Stewart reviewed the matter and, quote, feels there's been a breach of the tour code of conduct. It was inconsiderate to spit like that, and I know better, Woods said on Twitter. Just wasn't thinking, and want to say I'm sorry. The tour wouldn't give the amount of the fine. It's probably between $400,000 and $16,000. Nice range. Tiger wasn't thinking. That's a new one. Deadline Los Angeles. Southwest Airlines has apologized to a passenger who weighs nearly 400 pounds. The man said he was humiliated when a flight attendant asked if he'd bought two seats. At 385 pounds, Stephen Christen is not a small man, but he believes he didn't deserve the humiliation he said he suffered as he boarded a flight for Southwest for Seattle earlier this month. The flight attendant stepped up in front of me, and there were passengers behind me, just loudly said, "Did you purchase two seats?" he said. When Christen said he had not, he was told his size might be offensive to other passengers and in the future would need to buy an additional seat. But he was allowed to board the plane. "I was mortified," Christen said. "I just went in and got in my seat and just sat there silent." Kevin Smith, who was kicked off a Southwest Airlines flight because the airline determined he was too fat for one seat, tweeted about the incident to his followers, which made national headlines. Then, as for the latest incident, Southwest released this statement. "We were founded on the golden rule. We know our employees try each and every day to treat others the way they want to be treated. We deeply regret and apologize that we did not succeed in our interactions with Mr. Christen." Southwest policy requires passengers to buy a second seat if they cannot fit safely or comfortably into one or lower the armrest. Christen said he was able to sit and put down the armrest. Some passengers say they agree with Southwest's policy. Christen said the incident could have been handled differently. For the future, Christen says he won't be buying a ticket from Southwest again. Deadline New York. Provocative author, foreign correspondent, and filmmaker Nir Rosen is coming under fire for comments he made on his Twitter account after news broke that Laura Logan, CBS News foreign correspondent, I think she's the only one, was the victim of a brutal sexual assault while on assignment covering the news of President Mubarak's resignation on February 11th. A day later, Rosen issued an apology and resigned from his post as a fellow at NYU's Center on Law and Security. His comments on Twitter appeared insensitive from the beginning. Quote, "Laura Logan had to outdo Anderson Cooper. Where was her buddy McChrystal?" Rosen continued saying he thought it would be funny if Cooper had also been assaulted. A few minutes later, he made an attempt to be contrite. Quote, "I apologize for being insensitive. It's always wrong. That's obvious. But I'm rolling my eyes at all the attention she would get." A series of more sincere apologies followed. Quote, "As someone who's devoted his career to defending victims and supporting justice, I'm very ashamed for my insensitive and offensive comments. I'm deeply ashamed because they do not represent who I am. I would like to convey my most heartfelt apologies to Ms. Logan, her family, her friends, all women, and to everyone I have hurt, angered, or disappointed." He left out the men. Deadline Columbus, Ohio. Governor John Kasich addressed an apology to a Columbus police officer for a comment that garnered much criticism and media attention. This week, the governor called the officer an idiot at a state meeting, and then later met with Officer Robert Barrett to apologize. "Look, I apologize for my words. They were not appropriate," the governor of Ohio said. "My kids shouldn't speak like that, and I shouldn't either. You've got to be man enough to stand up and apologize. I'm a pretty spontaneous guy. I have to be. Words matter. My wife told me, words matter. You're the governor. She's right. Enough said." Former host on the Fox News Channel. Deadline Madrid, Spain said this week Iran has apologized for the detention of a Spanish diplomat during recent street protests in Iran. Iran was sorry for the incident and pledged it would not happen again, according to the Spanish foreign minister. The apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshear.com or kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through kcrw.com. And it'd be just like the Army Corps of Engineers Museum being open now, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, always available, until it's not, at harryshearer.com. And a couple of online tips. Touch My Junk premieres on mydamnchannel.com Monday of this week. This program is on Twitter, kinda, at The Harry Shearer. And if you're in Dublin, Ireland on Tuesday, come on along to the film festival and see The Big Uneasy. For information on where you can see The Big Uneasy in your area, TheBigUneasy.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from London.